Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On August 20th, 1965, in Haynville, Alabama, a young man named Jonathan Daniels and three other civil rights workers walked to Varner's Cash Store to buy a drink. It was one of the few stores that would serve blacks at the time. But Jonathan Daniels was white. He was a young seminarian from Keene, New Hampshire, but he went to Alabama because at the age of 26, Daniels had heard Martin Luther King Jr.'s call that white clergy come to Selma to aid the civil rights movement.
As they approached the store, Ruby Sales, who was just 17 years old at the time, was standing right next to Daniels. That's when Tom Coleman, a Haynville special deputy sheriff, stood in the doorway and confronted the group with a shotgun. Sales describes what happened next.
And he said, "I'll blow your brains out." And the next thing I knew, I was pulled backwards and I fell, literally fell. And Jonathan, I heard a shot, and it was Jonathan. He shot Jonathan. Jonathan never made a sound. I think he was dead instantly.
He was. Martin Luther King Jr. later called his sacrifice one of the most heroic Christian deeds of which I have heard in my entire ministry.
Next week, Daniels's classmates and others from the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge will embark on a 5-day pilgrimage to Georgia and Alabama to remember Jonathan Daniels' legacy, a legacy which deserves a much deeper understanding than it sometimes gets in New England.
Diane D'Souza is the Director of Lifelong Learning at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge. She's organizing next week's pilgrimage, and she joins us now in the studio. Diane, welcome to you.
And thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Also joining us today from East Chicago, Indiana, is Richard Morris Rowe. He's a former Catholic priest who was also shot that day in that same group with Jonathan Daniels. Mr. Morris Rowe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I wonder if I just might start with you. Could you? You were there. You were in there in that group of four in Haynville when Jonathan Daniels was killed. You got shot and were terribly injured. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened that day?
Well, we had been in jail from Saturday, I believe it was the 14th, until Friday the 20th. We were let out of jail very unexpectedly, and some were frightened because of that. They weren't given an opportunity to have any people to come pick us up. Where we had been arrested was some 20 miles from Haynville. Haynville was the county seat. Fort Deposit, where we were arrested, was about 20 miles south, same county. And a group had gone to this small store and had kind of been turned away, and so we decided we would go, and two of us went, four of us actually, mm-hmm. Jonathan, myself, Ruby Sales, Joyce Bailey, and as soon as we got to the store, we saw the shotgun, and then moving, didn't want to stay around, heard the same things that Ruby just narrated to you, and made it about 15, 20 feet and felt a shotgun in the back.
Wow.
Had heard the shotgun that got Jonathan. Didn't know what had happened till maybe 10, 15 minutes later when people were saying he was dead.
And you were gravely injured and had to spend many, many months in the hospital.
I spent 3 months in the hospital in Montgomery, Alabama, yeah. Where a wonderful surgical team gave a lot on a Friday night, six doctors to piece me back together.
Hmm.
11 hours of their work. Spent another 3 weeks there, and then I was airlifted to Oak Park Hospital in one of the Chicago suburbs.
Well, Mr. Morris Rowe, I'm wondering if I might ask you to tell us a little bit more about Jonathan Daniels himself, because you hadn't actually known him very long, and most of the time that you got to know him was during that time where the group was in jail for its civil rights activities, as you were describing to us. What was he like? What about him caught your attention?
Quiet, bright, reflective person. He was very well educated. Used to like to pray a lot. He'd get us doing Vespers in the afternoon, which was very unfamiliar to many of the young men who were with us in jail. But he tried to do that, and his real role in the South, he looked on it as one of supporting the black students who were working in Lowndes County and in Dallas County, where Selma is the county seat. He provided that support through the Episcopal Society for Cultural and Racial Unity. He provided transportation. He was a support person,
right.
A person behind the lines who felt it was important. He and Judy Upham, his companion, among the 8 students from Cambridge area, chose to stay down there. They stayed from March through August. John was about ready to go back to school to finish his final year at what was then Episcopal Theological Seminary, now EDS.
Right. Well, I just want to jump in here because I want to talk to Diane D'Souza a little bit more about the work that that Jonathan was doing in Alabama in 1965. He had actually received permission from the dean to go back to Alabama to do more civil rights work, and he was living with African-American families while doing that work. And we actually have a clip from a 1990 documentary entitled Here Am I, Send Me, the story of Jonathan Daniels. And we're going to hear from Alice West, one of the members of the families that Jonathan Daniels lived with in Lowndes County, Alabama.
You know, after I got to know John, it just came easy. I didn't look at the color of his skin then. You know, he didn't act no different from us. He ate out the same dishes we ate out. He took a bath in the same bathtub we took a bath in, used the same commode. He was just like family. In fact, he said we was his, you know, he called me his adopted. Say, I adopted him. And a lot of my neighbors was teasing me. Say, oh, say, out of all the children you got, Miss Bess, you had to go and get a white one this time.
So, Diane D'Souza, can you tell us a little bit more about what drew this young man from Keene, New Hampshire, who went to the Virginia Military Institute and then, of course, was a seminarian in Cambridge? What drew him into the civil rights movement?
Well, I think, as you pointed out, Meghna, it was the call of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that inspired him and others from the seminary to go down. You know, civil rights action and commitment is part of the DNA, really, of Episcopal Divinity School, then the Theological Seminary. And so he went down, but while down there, he and Judy Upham, as I hear the story, missed their connection to actually get back after that march was over. And in that space of time, as they reflected with other local people, they realized that all the white folks were leaving and that all the black people, the local people, were going to be right on the front line again. And so they thought that this wasn't the right thing to do. And when they went back to Cambridge, they talked with the supervisors there and made their case and said, we need to be down in solidarity, working with people, supporting the movement, just as Richard described.
Were there was he an exception in terms of seminarians from New England going down to the South during this time, or was he part of a larger group of, you know, people even from the Divinity School itself who felt that working the civil rights movement was part of their their training for a life in faith?
Right. Well, especially, I think I can't speak for all Divinity Schools, but I know at EDS that commitment to right action, so not just a prayer life, but a prayer life that makes a difference, brings social justice to light, is something that people worked very hard on. And in fact, I would say that Jonathan was almost a little late coming to some of his commitment to working on racial justice. There were others who had been on the lines much longer than he, but he had some experiences. He worked in Rhode Island for a time and got a sense, as he was working in Providence, about working with African-Americans and realizing, my goodness, these are people just like me. Mm. And so he got inspired both religiously and through those actions and decided that with the help, you know, and realization of Judy Upham, that this is a place that he wanted to be. And it really became his home and his commitment. He was determined about this.
Despite the dangers. By 1965, it was so clear already that not only for African Americans living in the South was it a very violent time, but for civil rights workers of any color doing their work in the South, they took considerable risk of life and limb. I mean, we've got more tape again from this 1990 documentary, Here Am I, Send Me, the story of Jonathan Daniels. And we're going to hear from Emily Daniels Roby, Jonathan's sister, remembering how concerned their whole family was for Jonathan's safety as he decided to spend more time in the South.
I can remember saying to him, your mother is going out of her mind because she's just convinced something awful is going to happen. And he said, I know, but I really need to go back down there for a while. I know that he was aware that it was dangerous, but if something needs to be changed or addressed and you've decided to be a part of it, then you're not going to back off because somebody's chasing you down the highway.
That's Emily Daniels Roby, sister of Jonathan Daniels, the young man who died in 1965 in Alabama that we're speaking about today. Diane D'Souza, we do have to just sort of tell a little bit more of the story of what happened. Tom Coleman, the man who shot both Jonathan and Richard Morrisrow, who's joining us also today, he was acquitted by an all-white jury, right?
Well, that wasn't, I don't think, very unusual at that time because black folks didn't only not have the right to vote, they weren't invited to be part of juries. And so the jury of Tom Coleman's peers were the white men who were his contemporaries in the town and in the county. And they felt that he acted within his rights, responding to a threat.
Mm-hmm. And Richard Morrisrow, when that acquittal came through, I mean, you had been shot by this man. What was your reaction to that?
I was in Oak Park Hospital by that time and just felt it was terribly unfair but not unexpected.
Mm. Now, why do you think that this is, what, the 16th pilgrimage that's been done mm-hmm. in Jonathan's name to Georgia and Alabama? Richard, why do you think it's important that this pilgrimage be done? What's the point of doing it now?
Well, the point of it is not only for Jonathan, but other martyrs in the South and the people who put it together. The Episcopalians are very careful to do that, to use Jonathan's death as kind of a focus for the deaths of many, most of whom were black at that time. And this is a time of year. It's a good time weather-wise. It gets people from around Alabama and the neighboring states and some like us from the north to come down and to remember Jonathan.
And especially this year, I mean, we're observing the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Summer, and next year will be the 50th anniversary of Jonathan's death. So, Diane, why...
And the end of the Selma March, which brought him there in the first place.
Exactly. So, Diane, why is it important to you to be part of this pilgrimage?
I think the thing for me, Jonathan, and I've said this when I've taught around Boston area over the last year to folks, Jonathan isn't very different from you or I, whatever our color of our skin. He's somebody who at one point decided, I've got to do something here. And it was one step he took after another. He never intended to be a martyr. He just wanted to do the right thing. For me, we're at a place in our country's history and in our city's history where racism is still existing, taking on different forms, and we need to also step up. So we are inspired by his example and looking at where do we need to make a difference today, whether it's the increased numbers of black Americans who are behind bars, or it's the Boston unfortunate ongoing violence that affects communities that are largely of color. We have to step up, and this is part of what inspires us to do that.
We should note that Jonathan Daniels' legacy is not entirely unknown in New England. There's a school named after him in Keene, New Hampshire. I also see that the Episcopal Church has added the date of his death to the calendar of lesser feasts and fasts, and his name is among 15 honored in the Chapel of Martyrs at Canterbury Cathedral in England, so he is getting his due. But in the last couple seconds that we have, Diane, do you think that there's more that could be done to tell this young man, this young New Hampshire man's story here in New England?
I definitely do. When I tell the story and when people think about it and reflect on racism as they're feeling it or experiencing it today, it opens up spaces for conversation and people are learning from each other and having a greater commitment to bring about change.
Mm. Well, that's Diane D'Souza, Director of Lifelong Learning at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge. She's the organizer of a 5-day pilgrimage to Georgia and Alabama next week in honor of Jonathan Daniels. He was killed almost 50 years ago in August. Diane, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
And Richard Morris Rowe, former Catholic priest from Chicago, joining us from East Chicago, Indiana. He was in the group where Jonathan Daniels was killed. He, too, was shot on that day in 1965. Mr. Morris Rowe, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a wonderful weekend and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.